The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Gaza, behind the failed ceasefires, terror tunnels to Israel, Palestinians, and the UN caught in crossfire, and larger new Mideast power plays.
Europe, Putin, the plane, and beyond. The EU finally joins stiffer sanctions on Russia. Investigators get to the downed jetliner in Ukraine. What next?
Immigration and litigation. House Republicans stumble over confronting a kid crisis on the border, but agree to a dubious lawsuit over Obama's executive action.
Marriage, inequality, and instability. New data on how a changing economy is shifting the shape of wedlock and divorce, American style.
A gender switch Sondheim. For fresh perspective on songs by the master, Jeff Horner sings some meant for women, while K.T. Sullivan takes those for men.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of August 3rd, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news, a story of which no American is proud. That was the State Department reaction accidentally released to the press to a forthcoming Senate report that CIA detention and interrogation practices after 9/11 amounted to torture, as President Obama later acknowledged. CIA Director John Brennan also apologized for agency searches of computers used in the Senate's investigation, which he earlier had denied. Now this.
The rights of Palestinians, even their children, are wholesale denied, and it's appalling.
I guess it shows that, you know, we're not just part of the UN bureaucrats. We actually do have hearts, and occasionally they break.
Israel and the Palestinian factions have agreed that they are now prepared to implement a 72-hour unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. Israel will be able to continue its defensive operations for those tunnels that are behind its lines, and the Palestinians will be able to receive food, medicine, and additional humanitarian assistance.
The destruction of a second UN shelter in Gaza last week added 20 more Palestinians to a body count now nearing 1,500. It also brought UN relief officer Christopher Gunness to tears during a TV interview about the collateral damage from continuing Israeli strikes triggered by Hamas rocket attacks. An international revulsion over the disproportionate death toll helped wrestle all parties into yet another proposed ceasefire, as described by Secretary of State John Kerry. But as with many past truces, it shattered after only 90 minutes in a suicide bombing that left two Israeli soldiers dead and a third presumed captured under ambiguous circumstances at one of those Hamas terror tunnels.
Israel quickly focused ground action on a search for the missing soldier, stepped up the pounding of areas it connects with continuing Hamas attacks, and decided against joining peace talks in Cairo with various Palestinian factions. To consider the roots of the crisis and the prospects going forward, for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Mideast veteran Frank Wuko, a 23-year U.S. naval officer and chief of intelligence operations at Special Operations Command Central. Deployed for Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, he is now the founder of Red Mind Solutions Incorporated, a Colorado Springs software development firm. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've written that the end of fighting will probably come only when Israel achieves its security goals, which now includes ending Hamas missile fire and destroying its tunnels into Israel. But can any military action assure those achievements will be permanent and that more missiles won't be built or smuggled into Gaza, more tunnels dug by angrier Palestinians?
Well, probably not. I mean, you certainly can't predict, you know, upon an Israeli withdrawal, what the Palestinians or more specifically Hamas will endeavor to do in the future. However, you know, these commitments, like any other military commitment that a nation undertakes, you know, for the Israelis, do not come, you know, without a price in both human life on both sides, but, you know, their side. I mean, you have to understand from the standpoint of the Israelis, they're doing this to protect their own citizens and to protect their own national sovereignty.
Before the ground action began, there were only a handful of Israeli civilian deaths from all those Hamas rockets, thanks to the Iron Dome anti-missile system developed with U.S. support. Could Israel defend itself better, avoid massive Palestinian bloodshed and international criticism by further expanding Iron Dome instead of returning fire or sending in troops?
Maybe. It's easy to sit from where we sit in speculate on what we think the Israelis should do. It's really not, I don't think, anybody else's judgment call to make on how they decide to secure the safety of their people.
Talk about the way the current confrontation is affected by the larger politics of a new Middle East, including much less support than before for Hamas from other regional powers.
Sure. Yeah, I would say, at least for the last 60 years, the powers that have become some of the traditional powers of the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, following the recent dismantling of the Muslim Brotherhood there and the replacement of that government with the more traditional Egyptian military-backed government. These countries, they want to progress. They really do. The Egyptians in particular, who also border that area and in fact border, Gaza, the Egyptians want stability in their country. The Egyptians want they've got millions of people who are living in abject poverty, who are who are saddled by a very weak economy and economic situation there. So that's their primary concern. As much as we think that the Palestinian issue, as much as it is an important issue on scale to other problems that are facing Middle Eastern countries, ISIS moving across Iraq, the deteriorating situation in Syria, the Palestinian situation is, to them, it's sort of losing steam. It used to be that some of these Middle Eastern leaders loved the Palestinian issue because it served as a great deflection from some of their own internal problems. I guess now the old saying, hey, listen, I've got enough problems of my own, comes to mind. And people, some of these countries are really expecting Hamas to mature themselves as a modern political entity and take care of this problem.
Does Israel bet that making civilians pay the price for Hamas terror will lead the majority of Palestinians to turn against Hamas? Do they really have the power? Does Hamas even have the power to control all Islamic terror elements in Gaza?
Absolutely. I mean, Hamas absolutely in Gaza. Hamas controls everything. I mean, Hamas absolutely has not just the power to control terror elements within Gaza. They are the government. They are the police. They are the controlling entity. Let's not forget where Hamas got its start. I mean, Hamas began really with the integration of two groups during the 1980s, one of which was the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, which provided, when people say Hamas is a charity organization, you really have to go back in time to find an entity in Gaza that functioned just about solely as a charity organization. And that was the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, led by Sheikh Yassin. And then you had the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the two, it joined forces, and this was the birth of Hamas. So, Hamas is everything. It's a terror organization. It is a political organization. It is fully in line with what they admit in their own charter are, Islamic tenets and ideals for. I mean, if you read the Hamas charter of 1988, they don't call for the destruction of Israel. They call for the elimination of the Jews globally, and they implore Muslims globally to join in their fight to eliminate the Jews. And this is horrifying stuff in today's age. And I feel, to fit the narrative that many political analysts want, and that is that both sides are created equal and the Israelis are sort of the big bullies on the block, we've chosen to very conveniently excise the fact that Hamas itself calls for the extermination of Jews, and who thought we would hear that kind of language again?
Frank Wuko is a 23-year U.S. naval officer and chief of intelligence operations at Special Operations Command Central. He deployed for Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom and is now the founder of Redmine Solutions Incorporated, a software development firm in Colorado Springs.
Next, Europe, Putin, and Ukraine, Beyond the Plane, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. As believers in the power of prayer, we covet the prayers of people around the world. That was Bruce Johnson, president of the SIM Christian Missionary Group that employs one of two Americans being brought back from Africa for the most advanced medical treatment possible of the Ebola virus they contracted while fighting the most aggressive and widespread epidemic of that disease ever. Now this.
The sanctions against Russia that we decided yesterday are taking legal effect this afternoon. But already, as I said last night, even the shadow of sanctions is already showing its impact on Russia's investment climate.
We reach the site shortly before 2 o'clock, stayed there until shortly after 3 o'clock, and then returned back the same way we came. Without any incident, left rebel-held territory into government-held territory.
There was belated progress last week on two fronts in the complex challenge posed by Russia and its stepped-up support for separatist militants in Ukraine, despite their mistaken shoot-down of a Malaysian passenger jet. International inspectors finally worked their way through continuing combat between the separatists and government forces to reach remainders of the plane and its human cargo that may provide undeniable proof that a Russian-made missile was responsible. And as European Council President Herman Van Rompuy reported, the airline tragedy had finally moved member nations to invoke stiffer economic sanctions, despite concern over Russian counteractions.
But the impact of the new EU and parallel U.S. sanctions remained to be seen, despite the Council President's early optimism. In fact, they sparked an immediate rally on the Russian stock market with a gain of about 2%, its best day since the beginning of July. To consider the economic, diplomatic, and military factors going forward for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Sarwar Kashmeri, a fellow of the Foreign Policy Association and adjunct professor of political science at Norwich University in Vermont. His most recent book is NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete? Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote last week that Putin could take a lesson from what Washington did wrong when U.S. forces accidentally downed an Iranian airliner in 1988. Remind us briefly of that incident and how the U.S. did handle it.
The United States had started to escort American-flagged vessels through the Gulf of Hormuz. And there was a U.S. Navy ship called the Vincennes, which was trying to fight off a couple of Iranian boats when its radar spotted an airplane coming at it. As it turns out, this was an Iran Airbus. And for some reason, even though it had pretty sophisticated radar at the height of battle and so on, it was not able to distinguish that. It thought it was an F-14 fighter, and it launched two missiles and shot down the Airbus, and 290 people were killed. The United States, Mr. Reagan was then president, apologized for the loss, but never really apologized for the American action. And that message has passed on through a generation of Iranians and leads now to really a lot of lack of trust between them and the United States, as we are seeing in these nuclear discussions taking place in Switzerland. And so my point in the U.S. News report was that Mr. Putin should think about this, because does he really want such a distrust to continue for a generation with the West?
Do you expect that solid evidence of a Russian role from the wreckage, bodies, black boxes, and satellite imagery would produce an apology from Putin? Or low-key de-escalation?
I really believe that the black boxes won't show us too much. To me, it's pretty clear that there was a missile that knocked this airliner down. The question is, who fired it? I continue to believe that this was an accident by the Ukrainian separatists. And I think the Russians fell down on the job, didn't provide enough training, and the radar mistook this airliner for a Ukrainian military transport, and the separatists weren't able to or weren't qualified to identify the difference. And by the way, I continue to believe the U.S. knows far more than we've let on at this point, because the President and Secretary of State went out quite a bit on the limb, and I think they wouldn't have done that unless we have a lot of stuff still in the drawer.
Is it important now for Washington to highlight all evidence of Russian involvement in the Malaysian air downing, or leave some ambiguity for Putin to save face and maybe de-escalate?
I think that's a really good question and a really important one. In my opinion, the administration is very adroitly doing exactly that, David, because they let out little bits of information at a time. And I think they will continue to do that. And hopefully Mr. Putin will recognize that there's a lot more in the drawer that can come out and take the opportunity to apologize and start de-escalating himself out of this.
Let's talk about gaps in the new EU sanctions, especially permitting France to continue a helicopter carrier ship sale that could make Moscow much more threatening to the Black Sea ports of former Soviet Georgia. I wonder if there will also be a loophole that permits Britain's BP energy giant to go ahead with a deal made with Moscow to jointly explore shale oil that could supplement Russia's depleting deposits in Western Siberia?
Another excellent question. For the EU to take any action, decisions must be unanimous. And it would have been very difficult to get France to agree to a decision on upping sanctions and killing military contracts if its existing contract for the helicopter warships, the so-called Mistral style of warship, was not allowed to proceed. And so a lot of these actions, including the contracts that still exist in England to maintain some of the military equipment in Russia, I believe had to be allowed, and future contracts are the ones that they tightened up on. I have a feeling that BP will also be able to do some of the past work, but will have a tough time doing things going forward.
Going forward, how can the West best help Ukraine develop strength and stability while acknowledging that Putin has reasonable concerns about being or being seen to be encircled by hostile forces?
Well, that is going to be the toughest management issue because Russia has said numerous times that Georgia and Ukraine are in its realm of influence, much like the Monroe Doctrine shut off the Western Hemisphere to others. That's what Russia believes Ukraine and Georgia are. And I think it's going to be terribly important to play a finely balanced, highly tuned act that says, okay, Ukraine is a separate country, and if they want to join the European Union, they should be allowed to do so, and at the same time be sensitive to Russia's respect.
We can't let you go without asking about the reaction in Europe to the repeatedly failed ceasefires in Gaza, the increasingly disproportionate death tolls of Palestinians versus Israelis, and what it means for the international support each side can count on.
This is, of course, I think, the most important issue that is being faced for American foreign policy. The 9/11 Commission, as well as a bipartisan report 2 years after that, pointed out very clearly that terrorists around the world, Islamic terrorists around the world, use the Palestinian-Israeli issue to keep their narrative going, to recruit more jihadis, to recruit more terrorists. And the more this lingers, the more dangerous it is for American foreign policy. My own feeling is that both America and Israel will find themselves increasingly isolated around the world. And I'm hoping that some way is found forward so that we can resolve this.
Sarwar Kashmiri is a fellow of the Foreign Policy Association and adjunct professor of political science at Norwich University in Vermont. His most recent book is NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete?
Next, immigration and litigation on Capitol Hill and beyond, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. The good news is we finally did something. The bad news is it was the 11th punt in the last 6 years and showed an inability to face a real problem and deal with it. That was Senator Angus King of Vermont on an $11 billion budgetary trick used for temporary financing of the Highway Trust Fund. Also passed last week was a $17 billion bill to expand and upgrade Veterans Administration medical resources and health care access to reduce its wait time crisis. Now this.
The crisis on the border is one of the president's own making, but he still hasn't learned his lesson. Now he's threatened to rewrite the law and take more unilateral action on immigration in the coming months. Let me just be clear. Such action would create an even greater incentive for more illegal crossings and make the crisis at our border even worse.
The present system of unilateral governance cannot stand. It must be stopped And even if it takes a lawsuit to do so, that's what we think the federal judiciary is there to do.
Republican Congressman John Boehner and Pete Sessions, in fact, getting House approval last week to sue over White House executive action, mostly along party lines, was a lot easier than herding the GOP majority behind strict, though largely symbolic, bills on immigration to satisfy its conservative base. There was an embarrassing 11th-hour failure, intrusion by Senate Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz, and an overtime session with the Senate already out of town and not likely to go along even when it gets back.
That left the crisis of child refugees on America's southern border back in the lap of President Obama with still more executive action in the offing. To consider the prospects for immigration, relevant legislation, and litigation over executive action, for your ears only, we're joined now by Josh Gerstein, White House correspondent for Politico.com. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's start with the House bills on immigration that were finally passed last week. How did they compare with Obama's request for $3.7 billion to increase border security, speed legal processing of child refugee appeals to stay, and upgrade facilities to hold them meanwhile?
Well, in terms of money, it's an awful lot less money. I think $694 million is what the House bill ultimately included. The president wanted $3.7 billion mostly for this border crisis. So it's maybe 20% of what the president asked for, though. In a sense, the money is the least of the difference. At least it would be a down payment on addressing the problem if it could go through. The problem from the White House perspective is that the House added a lot of other things on there, including repeal of a 2008 law that made it more difficult to return migrants from Central America, child migrants, to their home countries quickly. The Senate has objected to changing that law. So the whole measure, sort of regardless of what the dollar figure is on it, doesn't seem to have much chance of progressing. The House also passed a separate bill to try to basically block or end the Deferred Action Dreamers program that the president put into effect a couple years ago.
But the lawsuit authorized last week deals only with Obama's delaying a mandate for business under Obamacare, which Republicans have repeatedly tried to kill anyway, and not with executive actions Boehner blames for the border crisis. Why not?
There was a feeling that they may have had more of an opportunity on the health care issue. They decided to narrow down the lawsuit. If they covered a bunch of different subjects, legal experts said it was almost certain that this lawsuit was going to be tossed right out of court. And there are real questions about what the point of the lawsuit really is. For example, on the health care law, in addition to, as you point out, the fact that the Republicans actually don't want it enforced, although they're suing to force its enforcement, the president has said he's going to have those measures kick in next year anyway. We're now in August. So by the time this gets resolved, the same very thing the Republicans are objecting to will probably be in effect.
What have you learned about what steps Obama has in mind?
We believe that he might dramatically expand the so-called Deferred Action Program, maybe to cover the families of Dreamers. Dreamers is the phrase used to refer to children who were brought to the United States illegally by their parents some years ago, but have mostly been brought up here in this country. There's talk about maybe letting their parents, their grandparents, potentially even their children, all get the benefit of this kind of a program. And there's other kinds of things. There are U.S. citizen children, children born in this country, whose parents don't have legal status. The president might decide to cover them. It's a tricky thing, though, because if he goes too far on some of these measures, he could be blamed for the current border crisis if it were to become worse suddenly, if tens of thousands more children or families were to show up at the border, there'd be a lot of people quick to say, well, the president's encouraging this through his unilateral executive action.
How do you see the stop and start process, the intrusion of Ted Cruz to rally the most conservative House members, affecting House Speaker Boehner's leadership status and leverage?
Well, I mean, this was another reminder of the problems Boehner's been facing since he's been Speaker. You have this Tea Party caucus, this very hard right conservative caucus. And, you know, they caused very erratic driving by the GOP majority. On Thursday, they were debating this border security bill, this border surge crisis supplemental appropriation. There was full debate by Republicans and Democrats. It was headed to a vote. And all of a sudden, Boehner's office released a statement saying there'd be no vote. This is Obama's problem. Obama has to fix it. Moderate Republicans scratched their heads and went running to Boehner's office and said, this is nuts. How can we go home for the summer, go home for this August recess to face our constituents and have done nothing on this issue? And they actually forced the the Speaker to reconsider, the House to stay in another day and night, and vote on the measure on Friday, albeit one that is largely symbolic, because there's really no way to see how it could become law.
Switching back to the lawsuit, as you say, many see it as Boehner's way of diverting pressure for impeachment of the president, which some in his party have been calling for. But it also seems to be motivating a huge increase in Democratic campaign donations. How long can that go on? How long can the Republicans let it go on, given the time it would take to get some sort of a definitive ruling from the courts on a lawsuit?
Well, I mean, I think the House Republicans have launched this missile, and they're not going to call it back now. But you're quite right that it appears as a political matter and as a fundraising matter that it's at least as motivating and energizing for the Democratic base as it is for the Republican base. It's clearly something that's being done to satisfy the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. But all the polls suggest that a majority of Americans aren't crazy about the idea of the president being sued by the Congress. They're probably not crazy about anybody being sued for anything. And especially the Democratic base sees this as another example of the House treating President Obama unfairly and differently than it has treated presidents in the past. And so it's quite interesting, and we're seeing money continue to roll into Democratic coffers. I think both sides are trying to really exploit this for all it's worth.
Thank you. Josh Gerstein is White House correspondent for Politico.com.
Quote from the news, this is an independent commission and needs to be treated as such. Does the governor really want mass resignations? That was an email from a New York State Ethics Commission staffer angered by interference from Governor Andrew Cuomo, now under review by federal prosecutors.
Next, marriage, inequality, and instability for Your Ears Only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Standards of living are still stuck in the mud. That was Moody's Economics chief economist Mark Zandi on last week's less than expected 209,000 jobs added in July and wages only 2% higher than a year ago. Now this.
The girl that I marry will have to be as soft and as pink as a nursery.
It's not for me, with all its smug connubial joys, that ever constant smashing of toys wrecks your poise while hubby is out with the boys. No wedding gown for this silhouette, 'cause married I can always get.
A marriage, a loaded word these days with views even more varied than in those two old songs, as fractured as partisan politics and, like politics, driven in various directions by the winds of economic change.
In the 50s and 60s, a typical marriage consisted of a wife who didn't work and a husband whose steady job with annual wage increases and benefits could dependably support a family. In the 70s, that started to change, and with more and more women entering the workforce with higher levels of education, families became more egalitarian internally, but more unequal from one another on diverging economic tracks. With new data on the divergences and their impact on marriage stability, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Professor Stephanie Kuntz of Evergreen State College, also Director of Research at the Council on Contemporary Families. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
First, set the scene for us. Husband, wife, two kids, one dog in the house with the white picket fence. Typical images from, say, the 50s. How and why did that work and become a dream that was mostly achievable?
During the 1950s, you had just gone through the Depression and World War II. So for one thing, people were eager to start families again. You had the tremendous post-war boom. The United States was the only country that came out of World War II with its infrastructure going well. And the result was a tremendous period of prosperity where people rushed into marriage. The age of marriage fell to an all-time low. The rate of marriage rose to an all-time high. And you had the greatest number of male breadwinner families in all of history.
We know that women's income since the 70s has risen enough so a woman no longer needs a husband to survive. How has that affected the age women marry, and if they do at all?
Well, I marriage is certainly not dying, but the age of marriage has been rising, and it's been rising for two different reasons in two different sectors of the population. As women have become more educated, more of them are going to college, and more of them are couples want and need to have careers of their own, they are postponing marriage. That postponement of marriage among educated individuals is not a threat to marriage in the long run. And in fact, it used to be that college-educated women were less likely to marry than less educated women. Today, they're more likely to marry. And every year a woman postpones marriage up into her 30s, she actually decreases her rate of divorce. And educated couples, their divorce rates have actually been falling. We have quite a different situation in the less educated and lower income individuals, where it is just very difficult for women to find a marriageable man. On the one hand, they can earn their own income, not comfortably, given minimum wage and the other kinds of real wage losses that we've had. But they have to weigh their own ability to earn a wage against the declining position of low-income and less-educated men. And they have to. It's a much more tricky calculus than it was in the 1950s and 60s, because a woman who gets married and then divorced, or who has a man who is laid off or is burdened by debt, may actually be worse off in the long run than if she had focused on increasing her own earnings power.
Where does that leave the middle class, on which any economy depends? How do their chances for stable marriages compare to both the wealthy and the poor?
Well, we have this kind of odd definition of the middle class in America that actually includes what we think of as the traditional working class, people who earn $30,000, $40,000, even $50,000 a year as individual workers. Sometimes that can go up to more if there's two earners in the family. But people with a high school degree and maybe a little bit of college, who are the traditional working class, have been devastated over the last 30 or 40 years. The real wages of high school educated people have fallen by 41% since 1970. And although women's wages have been rising, they started from such a low base that they're still below men's. So these couples have really been hurt. In the middle class that we tend to think of, the college educated, you have an increasing instability even there. College educated couples certainly have more opportunity, they have more stability than less educated couples, but there's tremendous inequality developing among college educated couples as well. So you have more of them who are also falling out, or fearing that they will fall out or that their kids will fall out. So this economic insecurity and instability is really hurting everyone except the top 5%.
Would you expect to see changes in marriage and divorce data from an increased minimum wage, or from more people getting medical insurance through government exchanges rather than an employer or a spouse?
Well, it's hard to see whether that would actually increase the marriage rates. A lot of things have contributed to this. One thing that would definitely increase the marriage rate is certainly more economic stability. So an increase in the minimum wage might help with that. More social safety nets and a change in the behavior patterns, because the other side of this decline in marriage is that women can afford to be pickier than they were in the past. And the sort of things that women would put up with in the past, they no longer have to put up with. So we need to help couples develop the relationship skills that are continually undercut by economic stress and instability. From my perspective, more important than perhaps increasing the marriage rate is increasing the stability rate, so that you don't have, so that if someone does end up unmarried, they don't rush into having a baby because they have no other options in their life. And if they do have a baby, they are not doomed to poverty and to raise their kids in poverty.
Thank you. Stephanie Kunz is a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College and director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families. Among her books are A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s.
Quote from the news, "I'd just as soon keep this between us." That was then Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell discussing a secret transfer of $650,000, according to businessman Johnny Williams, star witness in the corruption conspiracy trial of McDonnell and his wife. She reportedly had a crush on Williams, who provided costly gifts and sought state support for a questionable medical product.
Next, Sondheim, he for she and she for he, for your ears only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. It's kind of like the final episode of MASH. That was Eric Amundsen, an electrician working on sets at New York's Metropolitan Opera as contract talks were extended in the face of a threatened lockout. Now this.
The pain on a terrace in Spain, would it pass? It would pass. Could I bury my rage with a boy half your age in the grass? Bet your ass.
For fresh perspective on the songs of Stephen Sondheim, or a demonstration of how well they can suit our shifting views on gender and sexuality, cabaret veterans Jeff Harner and KT Sullivan do a little gender bending in their new show, Our Time. She sings some numbers normally meant for a he, and he vice versa. The show continues this Wednesday and next, August 6th and 13th, at the Laurie Beachman Theater on 42nd Street in New York. And with an inside view for your ears only, Jeff Harner is on the line again now. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So are the critics right about this musical gender reassignment as a guiding principle of the show, or did you two just decide to sing Sondheim songs you usually don't?
When KT and I first sat down together to talk about song selection, I said to her, we've done many, many shows before, and I said in this show I'd really not like to sing a love song to her. I'd like to, because that's not really authentic with my own sexuality. So I'd really, you know, I'd like to never have a moment where we're actually singing I love you to each other. And I also said I'd really like to not recreate any moments from Broadway shows. Like, let's not be Sweeney Todd and Mrs. Lovett. Or, you know, let's not sing Barcelona from Company. And she loved that idea. And I told her that some of the songs I was looking at were actually ones that you usually hear a woman sing, like Losing My Mind or and Could I Leave You. And she said, oh, I love that because I've always wanted to sing Joanna and Pretty Women. And, you know, it just came from that. It came from, you know, just that kind of brainstorming. But I don't think we thought of it quite the way it's been received, which is great. I mean, I love that people are finding it so fresh. You know, we were just trying to be true to ourselves, you know, so the lyrics were really authentically ours, that it's KT singing and it's Jeff singing as opposed to all, you know, Fosca from Passion or Mazeppa from Gypsy.
Any songs you do that took a little more work because you don't usually do them, either because of the gender perspective or simply the fact that Sondheim can pack in almost more words than are humanly possible to sing, like in Not Getting Married Today?
Yes. Well, originally at our first meeting, KT was going to sing Not Getting Married Today. And then she and I simultaneously had the idea, you know, there's absolutely no reason why I can't sing it now because I could be getting married too. So, and that song I started on right away. That's a mouthful, Not Getting Married Today. And I've, you know, since it's just me singing it, it's not the way it's done in the show. I've kind of woven in some other songs that sort of justify the, I'm calm from Funny Thing Happened on the way to the farm to try and calm myself down in between the choruses of the frantic groom-to-be.
Which of the songs assigned to you are particularly fun to sing?
Well, that would be the one. I mean, that's just so joyful to sing that Not Getting Married Today. It's just, you know, it's just delicious language. I really do enjoy singing Could I Leave You? Just because it allows me to have I've never sung a song like it before. In fact, all of this material is new to me. I've never really felt ready to sing Sondheim. I just turned 55, and now I think that some of these lyrics really are believable now coming out of my mouth.
It's like Elaine Stritch saying, I'm still here, and everybody else is too young to sing the song. I wonder, is singing Sondheim harder for a performer than other theater songs? As a member of the audience at some of his shows, I often found them too complex even to whistle while walking out of the theater, even more so in the shower next day.
I understand that because Sondheim on first listening, especially when you're seeing, you know, hearing the full score for the first time, is very challenging to the listener. But the rewards for both the audience and the performer, I mean, I just love his language. I love, you know, I've always recognized how intelligent it is, but it's so specifically contemporarily human. I mean, it just absolutely feels like language that I would use if I were clever enough. But, you know, it allows me to really, it's not as challenging as I thought it would be because the emotional truth and the language all just seems to come together. And I think for the audience, you know, if you can get a cast album and listen to it before you go, that's always helpful. But I think the songs that we're doing are all very accessible.
Sondheim is a kind of god to many of his fans, and I imagine some of them might not take easily to scrambling the scripture. What's been the audience reaction, and have you heard anything from Mr. Sondheim himself?
Well, on Monday, I got an email from Mr. Sondheim's assistant saying that he would like, the boss would like to come to the show. And so, you know, we told them we have these two nights left, and they said, we'll get back to you if that will work. So there's a chance he'll come. We are going, because the run has been sold out with a waiting list, we have added a performance on Sunday, October 19th at 4 p.m. To accommodate people who can't get in this time, and also because the cabaret convention will be beginning the following day, and we know there'll be a lot of out-of-towners in for that. So there will be one more chance coming up this year to see the show.
Jeff Harner and K.T. Sullivan perform Sondheim with a Switch in Our Time Wednesday, August 6th and 13th, and Sunday, October 19th at the Laurie Beachman Theater beneath the West Bank Cafe, 407 West 42nd Street in Manhattan, concluding thusly.
Last year and I'm here.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, and stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugetz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
Because of new record levels of Ebola in Africa and more than 700 deaths, this week we go back just a month for our interview with an American doctor recently back from the front line of that uphill medical battle. From our June 29th, 2014 broadcast, hosted by Catherine Herzog and me.
We are facing an epidemic of the extent that has never been seen before, especially by the distribution of cases in the area. Other epidemics in the past have been much more concentrated than the one that we're currently confronted with. It makes our work much more difficult.
Doctors Without Borders epidemiologist Michael Van Erp speaking from the West African nation of Guinea, where health officials say drastic action is needed to stop the largest Ebola virus outbreak ever recorded. The World Health Organization reports at least 600 cases and 390 deaths in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. That's since the epidemic began in March. But this latest outbreak isn't just infecting and killing more people. It's also much more geographically widespread and moving closer and closer to larger, more densely populated cities, where the virus, with no cure, could spread even more quickly.
Ebola spreads by contact with the body fluids of an infected person, alive or dead, and has been described as an all-round horror show, which typically kills 90% of its victims. Aid organizations have set up emergency clinics in the region and employed hundreds of international and local health workers. Still, it was something of a surprise when the WHO dispatched Dr. William Fisher, a critical care physician and pulmonary disease specialist at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He thought WHO wanted his expertise at its Geneva headquarters based on his previous work with outbreaks of MERS virus in the Middle East, fatal flu in China, and earlier outbreaks of Ebola in West Africa. But out to Ebola-affected areas of Guinea he went. Back now for Your Ears Only, he joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. so much for having me.
When you first got the call from WHO in Geneva, what did you expect, and what sticks in your head most about what you saw when you got to the front lines in Guinea?
I previously worked at WHO on avian influenza in Geneva, and we had been in talks about me rejoining the Department of Pandemic and Epidemic Diseases to do some more work on technical documents for two emerging viruses, influenza and MERS-CoV. When I arrived, it appears that the plan had shifted based on the need for more physicians who had critical care training in to address the Ebola outbreak in Guinea. And perhaps either unfortunately or fortunately, I had a certain skill set that they were looking for. One, critically care trained. Two, that I could speak French. And that three, that I had experience in resource-constrained environments. So as I've mentioned before, it was a very different conversation with my wife when I told her that rather than staying in Geneva, I was on my way to a small village in West Africa.
Well, talk about the fear factor, both on the part of your wife, your family, and yourself when you actually got to that affected area.
This is a part of these outbreaks that's not often discussed, but there's a tremendous amount of fear on two different levels. One, on the fear of being ineffective, of not being able to provide adequate care to the people who needed it the most due to the fact that it is in such a resource-limited area. But there's also a tremendous amount of fear that that you'll be infected. And having a family, there's that extra burden that you know that they're worried about you. And so that was something that struck me as critically important in this effort because it almost prevented me from getting on the plane. Just the fear coming from the popular media about how this virus is portrayed, 90% mortality, horrific deaths, as you mentioned, the ability to decimate villages. What I found was quite the opposite, though. I found, thanks in large part to the organizational efforts of Doctors Without Borders and WHO, there was a structure in place that allowed us to really not focus on fear about getting infected ourselves, but really just to focus our attention on taking care of people who need it the most.
Well, given the fact that there is no cure, what does a doctor really do?
There's really two major goals. One is to identify patients who are sick with Ebola and isolate them so that you can break the chain of transmission. And then two is to provide them with aggressive supportive care up front to see if you can get them through. Now, the majority of people were presenting with nausea and vomiting and diarrhea and low blood pressure due to significant volume loss from their diarrhea and their vomiting. And actually, you can have a dramatic impact with aggressive fluid resuscitation and critical care management. That was something that surprised me as well. To be honest, I had my doubts about what we were going to be able to do. But we had a number of people that we were able to pull through this infection with just supportive care and antibiotics.
Talk a bit about the way local customs can play into the transmission modes of the Ebola virus.
One of the major mechanisms of transmission is the fact that when somebody dies from Ebola, families and friends pay respect to that person by washing their body and preparing it for the funeral. And so they're coming into contact with a lot of secretions that contain virus. And so actually, this tradition of preparing a body by washing it for a funeral often becomes a major foci of transmission. And this is a transmission that, you know, that it doesn't take sophisticated technology to prevent. I mean, with just barrier precaution, we can limit significantly the transmission of this virus.
Well, with no cure available and tradition sometimes against you, trust between local residents and healthcare providers must play a big role in reducing the rate of transmission. How do health professionals improve trust with affected communities and help try to quicken containment?
Trust between provider and patient is absolutely paramount. And if the patients don't trust you, they won't present as soon as they become ill. And the longer that they are ill in the community, the greater the chance that they can spread to other people, and the worse their chance at survival becomes. And you know, it's tough to blame somebody for not wanting to come to a treatment facility when history tells them that 90% of them will not come back alive. And so one of the major ways that we can improve that trust is to improve our mortality rate, that if we can get patients to survive, if we can get them through this illness and return them to their community and show them that this is possible, then there's going to be enhanced trust and earlier presentation in their illness. That was a huge motivator in what we were trying to do there. And I wasn't able to join the people who made it through their illness back to their village, but I heard it was a tremendous celebration when they were able to bring somebody who survived the illness back to their village.
Dr. William Fisher is a critical care physician and pulmonary disease specialist at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and UNC Hospitals, and was recruited by the World Health Organization to assist on the current African Ebola epidemic. Dr. Ebola, from our June 29, 2014 broadcast, as U.S. authorities prepared to bring back two medical workers infected with the Ebola virus, they assured Americans that there was more than enough containment to prevent them from spreading the disease. But the State Department warned against all but the most essential travel to the worst affected countries in Africa, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
More proactively, the World Health Organization announced a $100 million plan to rush more medical specialists and supplies to the overwhelmed area. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention pledged another 50 specialists, and a fast track for developing an Ebola vaccine was announced. West African leaders meanwhile authorized house-to-house searches by government troops to find and isolate more infected people. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, a song of pain and loss from South Africa's Ladysmith Black Mambaza.
Somebody say, hee, hee, hee. Somebody say, hello, hello, hello. Somebody, hee, hee, hee. Somebody cries, why, why. Somebody, hee, hee, hee. Somebody say, hello, hello, hello. Somebody, hee, hee, hee. Somebody cries, why, why. Somebody say, hee, hee. He to mango.
Yes, I'm a part in the world.
Somebody say,
he.
Somebody say,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say,
he.
Somebody cries,
why.
Somebody say,
he.
Somebody sing, hello, hello, hello. Somebody say,
he.
Somebody cries,
why?
Kulumani
sisu.
Manzinjani.
Baya, chabula basitanda. Yo, wo.